is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Ruiz versus Conoco.
May it please the court, Mr. Russell McMaine to represent the petitioner in this matter. Mr. McMaine to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Russell McMaine, counsel for Javier Ruiz. He is a brain-injured plaintiff who recovered a judgment that, in the final analysis, was an agreed judgment for in excess of $4 million. With the reservation to Conoco, the defendant, of two issues on appeal, one of which we won, one of which we lost in the Supreme Court, and the court granted our writ in the Court of Appeals, correct. The two issues being venue and limitations, and we won the limitations issue, lost the venue issue. We applied for writ of error to this court. The sole ground of reversal in the Court of Appeals was, of course, the venue issue, and that's what I wish to address most of my time to, though I will be happy to address the conditional writ in the event that the court is interested in that in my time. Otherwise, I will deal with it in rebuttal. The rather arcane but venerable issue of venue that has arisen in this case is really the question under what was formerly Subdivision 27 with regards to venue of foreign corporations as to the agency or representative of Conoco in the county of suit, which was Starr County. The evidence in this case was that was presented at the venue proceedings, which included the affidavits as well as deposition testimony by Mr. Wilkinson, who was the production foreman for Conoco that was on site taking care of a fixed and established place of business of Conoco, the Rincon Field, where they maintain 50 wells for about 40 years through a field office down there. The definition of production foreman was provided in their employee's manual. That was before the court. The testimony by Mr. Wilkinson was that he had authority with regards to contractual authority to bind the company on his signature so long as they were for items of either service or goods that were not in excess of $500. But that was the only limitation. That has never been an impediment in any of the cases that have. The fact that there is some kind of dollar limitation was never an issue. In fact, the question is posed by...
Wasn't there another limitation that they had to be from some pre-approved list?
Your Honor, in terms of the pre-approved list of vendors, yes, there was an approval list that was required. But that also has been in the cases before, has never presented any kind of a problem that there was a pre-approvement. Now, the Court of Appeals went off, and what Your Honor may be referring to, and concluded that actually there were pre-existing blanket contracts already entered into, which is actually not supported by the record. Mr. Wilkinson says quite to the contrary. The only argument about and the only evidence about blanket contracts is with regards to major vendors, that major suppliers of parts, but he actually did service contracts as well and parts as well. As long as they were on the approved list, there were not blanket contracts with all people that he did business with.
Is the evidence undisputed that Conoco would make payment based upon his signature alone?
I believe it is, Your Honor. Now, there is some argument that they make when you say, is it undisputed? Of course, remember now, we won in the trial court, and so I don't think that we have the burden of establishing that it was undisputed. We only have the burden to show that there was evidence that the trial court was entitled to believe. The evidence from Mr. Wilkinson was that, yes, his signature alone was enough. There was some suggestion by the other side in some of their cross-examination or testimony that there was that there may have been a required counter-signature, but he specifically testified that he did on a regular basis order materials and services in the amounts up to his authority and that they were paid.
Are you saying you went under the Milligan test, or is that not the appropriate test?
Well, Milligan is one of our lead arguments and is one of the arguments that certainly was more or less ignored by the Court of Appeals and its rationale. The Milligan test, of course, as the court is undoubtedly well aware from our briefing, which is somewhat venerable, but Justice Garwood wrote a long time ago in the interpretation actually dealing with Subdivision 23, but the same language and interpretation has been applied to Subdivision 27, foreign corporations, that the term agency, as used in the venue statute, refers to a situation in which the business of the defendant is in more or less regular and permanent form actually conducted in the county of suit. Then there is a disjunctive or that deals with the notion of representative with regards to broad discretionary powers. Now, there is discussion even in Milligan of the fact that there needs to be some, perhaps, indication of some authority to conduct business in the county of suit. And there, that's been some of the engrafting that has been attempted by the Court of Appeals. I think the significant case that they rely on, the Matco case out of Amarillo, is an attempt to suggest that that is some additional requirement, even though it appears in Milligan in the second half of the test rather than the first half. That is, on the representative part rather than the agency part. But the Court of Appeals got confused, frankly. In one part of its opinion, they recognized the Milligan test. In another part of its opinion, the court goes off onto the notion that there is some problem here because of some failure in proof, or some proof to the contrary, of the residence of the agent that we are talking about, or the representative that we are talking about. Now, under the agency concept, as espoused in Milligan, as opposed to representative, the residence of Mr. Wilkinson, not an issue. It's the source and site of where he does the business. That is the venue fact for purposes of the agency issue in Milligan, not the residence of any particular individual. The fixed place of business part, and in fact, this precise language was included in our pleadings and our affidavits and never even controverted, in fact, by Conoco. Couldn't controvert, because as I say, they have 50 wells. They've had them for 40 years. They have a field office. They have a production foreman with major supervisory authority down there, and who is responsible for maintaining and getting these things done on a regular basis, and has this contractual authority. So that if Milligan, if you engraft on the literal language of the Milligan description of the agency test, some additional requirement that an actual obligation exists to prove that there is business being conducted with third parties that originates down there, we met that as well. And that's really all we were trying to argue, and not trying to argue that that Mr. Wilkinson was a representative in the sense that you had to deal with his residence as being some kind of a relevant issue. Residence really is where the site is, situs of the responsibilities are performed under the Milligan and agency test, and that's what we were referring
to. Would you speak to the constitutional issue that the amicus brings up, whether or not we need to hold this case?
And, well, Your Honor, frankly, the constitutional issue, of course, never been raised. And
but we don't like to be reversed. We've been reversed before without even knowing we were.
Well, I understand, Your Honor, and I think even the United States Supreme Court would not consider that the issue of constitutionality had been raised. Mr. Gronzer has not raised it at any time, and I don't think that it's applicable in this case. But I might say secondarily, of course, that even when the venue issue was much more significant, when there was a necessity to prove a cause of action, for instance, against a resident corporation, a domestic corporation, but not prove a cause of action against a foreign corporation, that was upheld as being constitutional. And so I don't anticipate that to be a significant problem now that the legislature has even taken away that distinction in treatment between domestic and foreign corporations. So that the only argument that is raised by the amicus is there are a few more choices, is basically what their argument is. And the only other additional, the real difference between domestic and foreign corporation, the only significant difference between the domestic and foreign corporation that is in the statute now, is that you can sue a foreign corporation anywhere they have an agency or representative, whereas as to a domestic corporation, you can sue them where the cause of action arose, if they have an agency or representative, or you can sue them in the county of the plaintiff or the nearest county to the plaintiff's residence in which they have an agent or representative. So the suggestion that because there is some limitation great difference, I think is going to be considered nowhere close to the situation that is in the case that the Supreme Court has granted cert on.
If I could move you over into another area.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think that the probate court's finding that the plaintiff was non-compos as of January 24, 1984 is essential to your case?
Do I think it's essential?
Yes.
And, well, I would have thought it's essential but for the fact that the other side had stipulated that he was non-compos mentis from
well,
the date.
What if the earlier case that was dismissed had moved on to trial and the court there had appointed a guardian ad litem? That matter would have been taken care of as far as the court was concerned, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, there was never any attempt to appoint a guardian ad litem or any representative on behalf of the individual. Mr. Ruiz, in the two preceding suits, one of which was non-suited, one of which was dismissed without prejudice, was never sued on behalf of in any kind of a representative capacity or by any legal representative and had no guardian ad litem anywhere ever appointed for it. And no one had ever requested it. Now, if Conoco had wanted to request that, they knew what the injuries were. They could have done that. They never tried to do that at all.
But even though the suit was not brought on behalf, his behalf as a non-compos, he was listed as a plaintiff.
Well, that's correct.
Yeah.
He was named specifically. That is identical to the situation that occurred 90 years ago when the Court of Appeals in Texas first recognized in 1901 in the Galveston versus Washington case that the bringing of a suit even by a next friend in that case on behalf of a minor and then subsequent dismissal and refiling did not make any difference. He could read that there could be a refiling and that the statute of limitations was still told during the period of the minority. And so that issue was rejected specifically in this context involving minors, which is identical to the NCM situation, that as the courts have treated NCMs and minors, they come in at the same statute. The statute simply says it shall be told during the period of minority.
Court of Appeals says that Ruiz did not have access to courts for the purpose of suing for damages sustained by him until a guardian was appointed for him. Is that your position?
I agree with that position, yes, Your Honor. That he basically was not sui generis. The only argument that is made, really, by the other side is in reliance on a case involving prisoners, which, if the court will examine, deals primarily with the federal court's interpretations and the buying of federal court's interpretations in terms of bringing civil rights suits, and is a rather extensive effort to back off of the notion when, in fact, there is a prosecution, an attempted prosecution through to conclusion with regards to the limitations argument that was made there.
Is it your position that when there is a minor involved in a lawsuit, the trial court always has to appoint a guardian ad litem then, or there would never be a final judgment?
No, Your Honor, that's not my position.
How far can you go?
Well, no, yeah, I think that the court has never made, quite frankly, up and through the 1960s and early 70s, which I think Jim will probably recognize, if you didn't appoint a guardian ad litem, there was some recognition that there was a jurisdictional defect with regards to the proceedings. And that was also considered to be fundamental error in some respects. Now, the court, when they started backing off of what fundamental error was, and when the court started requiring that for some procedural deficiencies that there would have to be some objections made at the time in order to preserve it, and that was something that was waivable, then that issue was relaxed somewhat. But that was basically what the positions of the court primarily were. Only in the bill of review collateral attack proceedings on other underlying judgments that had been fully litigated was there any issue at all. In fact, one of the cases that we cite as well is a case which specifically allows such an attack. In the Great House versus Fort Worth Denver case, which specifically allowed such an attack.
Then, let me see if I understand. I'm trying to look at this case in a larger context.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any case involving a minor, if there is a motion by either party for the court to appoint a guardian ad litem, that motion must be granted.
I believe
that. Or else there is a problem with the finality of whatever judgment is rendered, be it for $10 million or zero.
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that the finality rules and res judicata notions are necessarily inconsistent with the tolling provisions with regards to limitations. And this court has dealt with different policy issues when dealing with simply a question of finality. And with regards to a judgment that is fully adjudicated and fully litigated on its merits. I'm not saying that there aren't some policies that come in to overlap at that point, but we're talking about the construction of a statute. Does the statute of limitations run? That does not implicate res judicata. Your Honor's question implicates res judicata policies that are not implicated in this case. Not something that has to be decided in this case. And not something that really is even pertinent in this case to begin it with. So we would submit that doesn't have to necessarily follow.
So you see no res judicata implications for the Harris County dismissal? That's pursuant to the rule?
No, Your Honor. There are no res judicata. It's a dismissal without prejudice anyway. So there's not any res judicata that could be argued in that context.
Right. Any other questions?
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Mr. James Kronzer will present argument for respondent.
May it please the Court, my name is James Kronzer, and I'm here on behalf of Conoco. There perhaps are some items that I should touch upon that have been mentioned by the Court. One, we have not contended that the provision authorizing suit wherever a foreign corporation has an agency or representative is violation of the Equal Protection Clause, and as the Court has pointed out, the amicus brief raises that question. Obviously, maybe it's just antiquity, but I thought that question had been laid to rest in the Adams case and, in fact, in one of their primary cases, Humble Oil versus Preston. The Beaumont Court, that question was presented to the Supreme Court, whereupon the plaintiff, Preston, withdrew his claim of his right to be sued in Jefferson County for fear that was going to be granted and something done. But the Supreme Court has, very recently, the United States, the real court hadn't yet, but has avoided that issue by certiorari denials and every other way. In fact, in the Adams case, which held there wasn't discrimination because it had to do with the basis upon which the foreign corporation came into this state. Now, all I can say about that, we didn't raise it again, but this court has on occasions said if it's a constitutional question and a true right, then it isn't waived by not raising it. So to that extent, we would like to be able to have the benefit of the grant in that question. The grant means nothing. It's just what they do. But there is a load on foreign corporations as compared to domestic corporations. That's been recognized by the Texas courts ever since we had 23 and 27. And there still is a load under 27. Another question that Judge Hightower posed that is important to me is, as the court very well knows, Mr. Ruiz sought access through his wife and through his attorney. And it was not, they never raised the question of his incompetency. That question never reared its head until 5 years after this accident, after the Harris County and the Zapata courts dismissed their claims. What we have here, Mr. McMain's firm appeared in the Houston forum and asked to reinstate the dismissal then, saying he had authority to do what he was doing. And then when the case was not reinstated for dismissal for discovery abuses, they then went to the probate court and residence of Mr. Ruiz and had him adjudicated of unsound mind from the inception, and more than 5.5 years after the accident, filed this suit in Starr County, alleging that he'd never had access to the court, notwithstanding the decisions that say that a lunatic can be represented by a next friend or a community survivor or a lawyer. Now, what the Court of Appeals here held was that the failure to have had a duly appointed guardian of the person and or the estate of Mr. Ruiz meant that no judgment could be validly given, dismissal, final judgment, or anything else. It's simply meaning, Justice Hightower, suppose that Judge Tennant in Houston had reinstated his case and it had proceeded on to trial, and he had lost it before a jury. Under this reasoning that he's never had access, a new trial would have to be granted then. Now, that's almost incomprehensible to suggest that these statutes have ever been or ever were passed for that purpose. And whether you do it by hypothetical or any other way, because this case makes its own hypothetical. The claim was never even made of incompetency until after two district courts had dismissed the case in the teeth of the same counsel's representations to those courts. They had authority, and now that authority, of course, is disavowed. We can't make it any clearer than the timeline here why we think it was unfair to let a prisoner he went down the pike under the same statute because he didn't know enough about the mechanistics of our system, how to get the process out. And say he was out and gone. And to say that coming in with counsel or these incompetence is not, and two next friends and a wife, is not an access to the court is actually beyond us, and that is our claim of error. The question of the venue, there are at least three aspects of the venue problem that kind of make an interesting, at least academic, consideration. This court, it is a significant case. It's been 40 years since this court has touched the meaning of agency or representative as used in the statute. Statutes haven't changed. This is the first time the court, so far as we know, has considered what the overlay and impact of its 83 rules amendments and the legislature's the statement that when the matter is on appeal, when it's on appeal, the whole record shall be considered. And the plaintiff takes his risk in the trial court in advancing to the point of getting a court to stay with him, that there is a venue or prima facie venue. Now, that the statutory test makes the question of whether the trial court accurately did his thing a law question. There's no reason for, they say, no jury trials, no evidence, and then you review the entire record, unless it becomes a law question, just as you decided in State versus Slobom, dealing with Rule 128, the special appearance rule, just as you've done for years in the motions for new trial, in default cases under Strachbein versus Pruitt. Those are de novo law considerations. And just as the rule itself says, and just as the El Paso court has stated since the passage of this law, and just as have the Amarillo courts, it has to be so considered. But we don't even need the court to make an interpretation, which I guess it will, of what the meaning of the new rules and the statute mean, because under the law as it existed in 83, when you really had the trial on the trial, the very thing the court and the legislature were seeking to get rid of, the majority, the vast majority of the cases reversed in situations in which the agent had more power than he had. Those cases are cited, and I want to make that clear, that even without regard to what the effect of the new rules were, and the statute saying consider the whole record, even without that, after the decision in Milligan, in these all field cases, with the exception of one case, that's Preston, which got withdrawn out of the Beaumont Court, all of the cases have held on the facts, sufficiency was the test then, that they didn't make the Milligan agency or representative test. So it is, as far as we're concerned, the court doesn't have to come to grips with that question.
Can you point to language in Milligan?
In Milligan?
Which you believe supports your position?
Yes, in two ways, Your Honor. One is the quote, the or language, which it says. Do you have it? Anyway. But the preceding language of Judge Garwood for the court is on the previous page to the, we got it in all the briefs, but the, in which he said, conversely, I guess it's important to remember that Milligan was not a case of respondeat superior. What it was a determination of what an agent or a representative had to be to permit a company to be sued in the county of where the plaintiff filed. And the agent in that case was not an individual. It was the Northeast Texas Motor Freight Lines, which contracted and booked stuff for Southern Motor Express. That is, it would make its billings and get their stuff to deliver and take it to their docks and make binding contracts for them. Now, the court said as to that type of agency, not respondeat, but a true agent to which they were doing business is what is being talked about. That was sufficient. But as to but so long as they had these broad powers of contracting to bind. It then went on and said, conversely, and I'm reading, Mr. Chief Justice, conversely, the more or less permanent possession by a resident of the county of a broad power of attorney of the defendant might well make such a person an agency or representative, even though his high position necessarily involved powers of discretion far beyond those of a servant and therefore similar to those of an independent contractor.
Well, as I understand, Mr. McMaines argued that agency or representative can be broken down to two different categories through this case, and that
and
he's
I
not
believe
claiming
that.
There's a representative. He's claiming
he is now.
An agent.
He wasn't in the court of appeals.
Well,
you make that clear. He found out that that has a problem. But an agency, because that's what the court was dealing with, this court was dealing with in Milligan.
But do you agree or disagree that though that agency or representative constitutes two different tests, or do you think it's one test?
I think that if it's an agent, it doesn't have to be in the respondeat superior chain of liability. It can be an independent contractor doing business with the third party, just as was true in Milligan. But even as to that, that agent has to have broad powers to bind and contract. But if you are relying on...
How broad? Here, the man had authority to bind the company for $500.
Judge, he didn't.
Qualify. How broad?
He didn't. That's the first thing. He didn't have authority to bind the company. What he had was pre-approved people. The company said you can buy from them, and even after he did.
And he decides what to buy and what not to buy and when to buy.
That's correct.
Well, why does that not give him discretionary power?
Because that's just a menial task of a fellow that's delegated authority. That's exactly what these cases are talking about.
To oversee 50 wells and present
He's not done oversee them all, the field superintendents and everybody else. But let me make it very clear.
Where would you draw the line?
Let me
what
make
amount
it.
Of money would you draw the line?
I wouldn't draw it on money. I would draw it on authority, and that's what these cases do. Judge, let me only say this. I guess it's the only answer a lawyer can make before you. That the cases that are mentioned in our brief, the cases that are mentioned in the opinion of the Court of Appeals, all field cases, all hold that such a person as we're talking about here is not an agent with sufficient authority to meet the Milligan test.
Well, how about representative? What's the problem?
Well, as a representative, because it's clear a representative has to be a resident of the county.
The argument is where he resides or he conducts business.
No,
what
but
is
that's
the focus?
Not, but I'm saying to the court, just as the cases, including Milligan, when you're talking about a representative, somebody like this, and if it were not so, there wouldn't be a major company in Texas doing business. It wouldn't be amenable anywhere it was doing business. And that is not the purpose. There would be no purpose of the limitation of agency or representative. But all I can ask you, Your Honor, is to read the cases since Milligan, and even without regard to the changes made by the new statute. And I can give them to you now again. But they're in our brief. They're in the Court of Appeals opinion. And they uniformly, under the old sufficiency of testing rules, that's the big significance, held in reverse district court rulings saying there was a sufficient representative in the county who had more authority, if the court please, than Mr. Wilkinson had. He wasn't anything but a menial servant. And by that, I don't mean meniality of his labor. I'm talking about
authority.
A person with authority, and he didn't have it. So it is that in the other, in the last round, I see I'm about to run out of speed. The last round is that they, in effect, through the lawyer conduct in Houston, voluntarily dismissed the case that fixed venue in Houston from that act. That's where they wanted to be until they struck out 5 years later. That's where they wanted to be, in Houston. And that's where we'd like to have them back if you're going to deal with the venue question at all. The same is the bottom line of the summary judgment question. At the very least, if we're not entitled to a judgment as a matter of law, that the judgment, these dismissals, were just as in Johnson and just as in Greathouse, they were avoidable judgments, whether they were dismissals or final judgments, and it's necessary under the clear law to treat them as voidable and come back in the jurisdiction and seek to get them set aside in Harris County where this first one originated. Either way, you just can't say they're void and just attack them anywhere.
Neither one of these judgments were final judgments for res judicata purposes. In other
words,
if there was no limitation problem, he could have kept going.
The same thing, though, is true, if the court please, of the prisoner case.
Okay.
Same thing.
Be that as it may. He could have kept going but for limitations. But for your saying that he's run out of time.
They were not dismissals with prejudice.
Right.
Or final judgment.
So if both these suits had been brought and somehow went away within 1 year, there'd be no problem here.
That's correct.
And the question is,
only one problem. He would have to come back into the forum of dismissal first to test by bill of review. That's what Greathouse, the case the Court of Appeals relies on.
Why? I mean, if it's not a final, if, If it's not a final judgment for res judicata.
Well, it is for purposes of a DWOP, dismissal for want of prosecution.
You're saying you have to go back into that county?
I'm saying you have to get first.
I can file in three counties, and I file one of them. You have a mean judge who has a DWOP docket every 3 months, and I get DWOPed out. I can't go to my alternative court.
No, I didn't say that, because those are not, they're still live and active. But what you're saying is that regardless of the activity in Zapata County, the want of prosecution, or Houston, for failure to buy discovery matters, that limitations is held in abeyance or told until you get out, and then 5 years later.
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'm saying had the Zapata and Houston both been concluded within a year, and then this would have been brought in Stark County, you would have...
There's no question. He has no impediment or bar to seek relief elsewhere, he doesn't have to be NCM or anything else to do that.
Right. That's what I mean. Now, the problem is, if he were a minor, it seems clear to me he wouldn't have to tell the court he was a minor to have the ability to bring another suit under these circumstances. I mean, limitations are not told against a minor. It's easy to prove it, even if you don't tell the court in your pleading. And so I'm trying to understand how we draw a test in this situation where he's claiming non-compos mentis and that claim is not made known to the courts early on in the proceedings.
Dealing with a minor, of course, we now have a mixed bag of statutes dealing with minors. They don't all get 2 years after they're 18. There's other types of medical mal, things like that, where the statute itself varies as to the time factors. But what I'm saying that there was access in this case by his wife and by a lawyer and two sets of lawyers.
Well, you present a fairly strong equitable. You've made an equitable pitch here, which I believe is fairly strong, but I'm trying to understand how that can be reduced to a test that could operate fairly over a broad spectrum of situations.
Well, the only way I can answer that, Judge Phillips, is to say that did he have access to the court? The prisoner case is not the only case dealing with what is meant by access. The courts of Texas, including this court, Victim Truth, back in the turn of century times, has held a lunatic can have access through an attorney into the court system to the extent that the a title coming through that lunatic is valid unless set aside in a direct proceeding. Now what we're saying is that at the very minimum he had access to the court system and that he has to at the very least come back where he had access to seek it after limitations have otherwise run, because they would, he just can't do it unless that judgment was entered that way.
Let me ask this question one more time, and I don't want to take any more of the court's time or yours. Everything had been the same here, temporally, except Ruiz had been a minor through all of this.
Mm-hmm.
That was his disability problem. Could he, at the 5.5-year mark, have brought this suit in Stark County? If he were still a minor or still within the post-minor?
The answer to that, I guess it's the same, and maybe I have obfuscated. If he had access to parents or the next friend or some representative, and that's the whole purpose of those type of statutes, to guarantee access. If he'd had access, yes, I'd say he'd be exactly the same situation, even though he wasn't 18.
Okay, that's my question.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, if I may, I would like to make an immediate retort to the last argument in regards to the statutory construction issue, because historically, what this court has always said about this statute is that it is a remedial statute to be liberally construed to effectuate its purposes with regards to the non-running of limitations. And that's part and parcel of what the interpretations have been. As we indicated, 90 years ago, courts had recognized that in a minor situation, that the filing by an ex-friend, dismissal then, more than 2 years lapse, no problem. Statute of limitations doesn't run. In regards to the Johnson versus McLean argument, which is the prisoner argument, I call the court's attention to the fact that it's of incredible significance in the Johnson versus McLean holding is the reliance on the federal cases, and specifically the court's reliance on a case at page 792 of the opinion, where they talk about and make a distinction, because they say in Stevens versus Curtis, which is a federal civil rights case, it's held that the Texas statute of limitations applicable to an inmate's civil rights action against a police officer was not told. The court stated at common law, a convicted felon was, and I'm not very good on my Latin, civiliter mortis, civilly dead, and therefore did not have a legal passage to prosecute a suit. The Texas Penal Code originally codified the common law rule, but the code no longer contains provisions for forfeiture of civil or political rights as a possible penalty for criminal conviction. The outdated assumption upon which the 1897 tolling provision for prisoners is based is wholly inconsistent with the court's present experience. The point being that the distinction made in the limitations area in the Johnson case is specific to the prisoner notion and the notion of being civilly dead and the notion of NCMs not being persons that can prosecute actions in their own name, and same thing with minors, has not changed and has not altered, unlike the prisoner situation. There are no cases in Texas before or since that apply that in the Texas context. Now, the suggestion is made by Mr. Cronzer that we don't have a single case with the facts similar to this that sustained venue, which is absolutely not true. We have a number in addition to the language of the cases, but the Mobile Oil Corporation versus Cook case, which is also an Amarillo case, has specifically on in its opinion at pages 932 and 933 the situation identical to ours, which says the evidence showed that Mobile had a field office in Pampa, Gray County, with agents and representatives who resided in Gray County and who had authority to make contracts for pulling and working over pumps, repairing pumps, purchasing supplies, and other matters concerning production of oil and gas from wells owned by Mobile, although there were limits of $1,000 and $5,000 for which they could contractually bind Mobile. We have limited authority binding with regards to the existence of the field, similar to Mobile.
There was clearly residents in the county. Here the proof is.
And of course, the argument, actually the courts frequently have confused the notion of agency or representative, or they have just collectively dealt
from
with the notion of agency.
From the quotes in Milligan, I'm confused too. At one point appears to be the same.
Well, Your Honor, Milligan suggests, and the only significance of the agency is distinct, or the principal significance of agency with regards to what I think the level of proof in this case, and that's required, is that we don't have to prove the residence of Wilkinson. The residence of Wilkinson is not an issue. That's an issue only with regards to the representative section. That's made clear by the cases. So that's not an issue. The only issue is, from all of the cases, is the situs of the business activity for agency purposes. And as we indicated, Milligan, of course, talks about fixed established place of business. Clear they have that here. That's not really an issue. That they have a fixed established place of business. They've got 50 wells. They've been there for 40 years. That's what they're doing. They're producing. With regards to testimony, however, and where I think the court and perhaps the place next after the court, through Justice Garwood, writes this, then the court goes on to note that Texarkana suggests that there must be some kind of contractual binding authority being conducted in the name. Not that the person has to live there, but that there must be some binding authority in the name of the principal. And then the court says, but whether the Texarkana court be correct or not, therefore not really saying whether that's an issue, which is one of the reasons for the problem, in its thesis that an agency cannot exist without the power to contract with the principal, such power and its regular use in the very name of the principal as the contracting party are certainly the strongest indication that the principal is doing business through an agent. The court in that case says the fact that they did it is a venue fact that meets the preponderance of the evidence test, let alone the prima facie test, which is the one that was enacted by the legislative enactment in this court's companion rules in Rules 87 and 87.3. In fact, the court, under the prima facie test under 87.3, has no doubt, no choice. The trial court had no choice under the existence of the evidence but to sustain the objection to the motion to transfer venue. The suggestion as to how these issues are to be reconciled in light of the statute is discussed by the Austin Court of Appeals in Humphrey versus May, and we would submit that it doesn't change the basic standard. We made a prima facie case for venue, and this case should be reversed and rendered in our favor in accordance with the agreed judgment. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in the second case. Court will take another brief recess.
Thank you. Please rise.